And that's when it really hit me, to the points that we were making earlier. It's these people around you that encourage vulnerability and that make you feel safe and kind of give you a safety net that allow this behavior to happen. And I think that that's where confidence grows out of, because Sean felt confident doing that thing, knowing that there was a good chance he could mess up and that he could embarrass himself and that he could look like a goof, because he knew that he had somebody there that loved him and somebody that just wanted him to be himself, no matter how goofy or weird or incredible that could be, and just would love him as long as he was being himself.
This is Living As You. Here's your host, PQ.
What's going on? It's time for some PQ energy and Living As You magic. Let's go. Today on Living As You, we sit down with one of the best in the world at living authentically as himself. Matt Williams knows a thing or two about vulnerability and living freely. Whether he's looking at the world through the lens of others, creating the most trusting of authentic spaces, or taking the time to craft his own personal niche, Matt's light and willingness to live as himself is a testament to all the work he's put in. An adventurer and a dedicated educator, he's here today to help each of us live more freely and vulnerably in our own lives. Get ready for greatness.
Patrick.
My man.
Look at Matt, this wall behind me. This is legendary.
Dude, come on. Come on.
It's like you're almost on Joe Rogan level here with your own little at home studio.
I got to do what I can to bring it for the man. Let's go. The sailing man. Oh my gosh. Yesterday and then today. Out on Lake Michigan, the waves, you got the wind. Dang, you can probably even see Wrigley with your eyesight, Matt.
I don't know. I'm not that impressive.
Hey, thanks for being willing to do this. This is so fun. I was thinking we start things off today by diving into your summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. I mean, come on. It's the highest mountain in Africa. The highest single standing free mountain in the world. You got 20,000 feet above sea level, 60,000 feet in the air. Tell me a story about that experience.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience. I did it alone, obviously, not completely alone. I did it with the help of a team of native Tanzanians, but I did it without anybody that I knew going in, without anybody from America. And the coolest part of the experience because of that was that there were only four people going up the mountain on the same time scale as I was. So it was me and my team, and then a Canadian man in his late 60s, and then two Tanzanian women who were maybe just a few years older than me. And we were the only ones at camp every night. So usually our team would leave earliest in the morning, and then we would walk up to the next camp. We'd get there, we'd unpack, we'd hang out for a bit, and then the three of them would arrive afterward. And we would spend the evening together at the camp before continuing on the next day. And I'll be honest, that was one of the most challenging and isolating times of my life, based on one, just the sheer difficulty of the climb, but then two, on top of that, the fact that I didn't have anyone there that understood me, that I knew that I had this prior connection with and an emotional attachment to. However, after about 3 or 4 days on the mountain, in fact, I remember the exact day that it happened, we had a whole afternoon together. It kind of just clicked that I had just as strong, if not more so, of a connection with these people on the mountain that I did with anybody back home that I had known my whole life, that I had been to school with, that I had played on a sports team with, just based on the shared experience that we had. And then in particular, these people on the mountain with me, the shared values. Obviously, we valued hard work. Obviously, we valued life and wanting to do something with our lives. We valued community and connectivity because we were here talking to each other and we cared about one another and making sure that we were healthy and happy on our way up the mountain. So that was really a breakthrough moment for me in a lot of ways, just to realize that you can find as much connection with really a complete stranger in the middle of an intense experience than you can with somebody you've lived with for 3 or 4 years on a college campus.
Was there a particular conversation think back to when you think about your time on Mount Kilimanjaro?
Yeah, you know, I think that the conversation that stands out to me the most, and it's in part just due to the scenery, was late in the evening the night before we went up to base camp for summit. So you summit at midnight, So the way it works is you would go up to base camp and then sleep for an hour or two and then summit. This was the night before that when we were kind of preparing for that most difficult leg of the journey. We were still a little bit relaxed. We weren't at the highest altitude yet. And you're so high up at that point that when you look out, you can not only see all the stars in the sky and the Milky Way, but it literally feels like you're in the stars. It's like you're swimming in them. They're not above you. They're just like around you. And it's incredible sitting on the edge of the mountain too, where it just slopes off into nothingness. And it's not like a normal hike where you can see the ground below and you go, oh man, we're really high. Like you don't see anything. You see land going down and then you see stars above. And it's this disorienting, like the earth has reshaped itself and you're just planted now and you can't really tell up and down. And so we were sitting outside talking and I was speaking specifically to a girl named Sabrina, who was one of the Tanzanian women that was on the climb as well in that same kind of leg with us. And we were just talking, to be honest, I think about what motivated us in life and why we had come to do this and why we had chosen to do the things that we had done. She had gone actually to Dartmouth in the US as an exchange student and since moved back to Tanzania and was now working in banking. I, at the time, was a sophomore, or after my sophomore year at Notre Dame. So I was in the summer going into my junior year. And I think the breakthrough for both of us in the conversation was the difference between what we really wanted to be doing and what we were doing, which was more immediate for her having graduated and chosen, as opposed to for me still being in school, still thinking about the process. I hadn't made that decision yet, but it was a decision I was wrestling with. Should I choose to do the thing that I feel like I have to and I'm supposed to? And so for her, and she's actually doing this now, and I follow along with it, and I think it's amazing. She wanted to start a cooking blog, kind of a cooking show. And that was really her passion. And she has a job at the bank, but she didn't enjoy it. And she really wanted to have a cooking channel where she would cook local recipes. She was from the island of Zanzibar. So she wanted to kind of put their cuisine in front of people. And for me at the time, I didn't really know what that passion would look like, but I was pretty sure that it was very different than whatever I was currently on the path to. And I sensed that fork in the road. So I think we talked about that. We talked about how we viewed life and what had pulled us to climb a mountain like Kilimanjaro. And I think I felt just as connected to her in that moment as I have anybody else in my life.
And that personal connection, especially the people who you may have never met, I think I definitely want to share about our experience at Notre Dame, how we met each other in the same dorm. But Matt, in two conversations in North Dining Hall and the busyness of Notre Dame, I felt like I had that same connection with you in the way we were able to dive into our stories, our hearts, our shared experiences, the things that we brought to the table that maybe the other one hadn't experienced. Tell me about the idea of carving a personal niche in the midst of personal connection in the world. That's something we've talked about quite a bit, especially in a society that likes to say, oh, Matt Williams, you went to Notre Dame, you majored in anthropology, this is what you're going to be doing.
No, it's a great question. I think I want to take a quick step back there and just preface this all by saying that a niche biologically is the idea of where you fit into an ecosystem. So an animal's niche just is strictly defined as its role in the ecosystem, how it survives, what it eats, where it lives, what it does. And so when I say niche and when I talk about a human's niche, what I'm really thinking about is what's your unique role in your ecosystem, in your community, not the role that you're told to play, not the role that other people assume you play, but the actual role where you survive and thrive within that specific community. And so for me, the idea of finding your niche or creating your niche perhaps is utterly important to living as yourself, to leading with your heart, to being vulnerable and authentic, because you can't allow other people, or other people won't be willing to see you as you are unless you've created a space for you to be what you are and what you want to be. And what I mean by that is, until I had created a space for myself at Notre Dame where I had this crazy hair, where often I would walk around barefoot, where I would wear goofy wolf shirts and acid wash jeans and just do crazy things throughout the day, people put me in boxes. The same way that you bring something home and you organize it, it goes into this drawer, that drawer, and your sock drawer, you have that broken down even further. I think we have a tendency to look at each other and say, ah, that person looks this way, they talk this way, they study this thing. You already mentioned the majors, the place that someone's from, and we start to label them and we make it very hard for them to be themselves. And if they want to try, now it's like they're fighting upstream. They have to fight against this current that we've already put in place because we've made all these assumptions about them. So for me, the idea of a niche is really much more substantial than just the things you do. It's literally a place that you've created in that community that belongs to you, where people have to see you as you, not the things that they might want to think about you. And so for me at Notre Dame, the personal niche that I created, I think, meant that every time I talked to someone new, they had no idea what to expect. They had to meet me face to face, eye to eye, and let me build that relationship from the ground up, as opposed to coming in and thinking, I already know these things about Matt Williams. I've already made these assumptions about him. Now let me see if he lives up to them. And that for me is really the key to creating space for yourself to live authentically and vulnerably, because you have that physical space, quite literally that mental space around you to explore, as opposed to people cutting that off prematurely based on what they think they know about you. Does that make sense, or should I try to explain that differently?
Agree. No, Matt, that makes complete sense. I want you to say a little bit more about your headspace and decision to have an afro, to walk around barefoot, to approach conversation and daily life at Notre Dame with that Matt Williams authenticity, when so many other people would say, I'm never going to do that.
No, I think this is great. This is going to force me to reflect in some important ways too. Because when I came to Notre Dame, I was not like that at all. I was somebody my whole life who had lived, I would almost say, like outside of my own body. If I was in a room full of people, half the time I wasn't viewing it from my own eyes. I was trying to imagine, how does this look to other people? How do I look right now? How does my body language look? When I walk this way, what does that look like? Is what I'm wearing cool? Is the way that I'm talking cool? Are the words that I'm saying cool? And so I spent a lot of my time, I hate to say, not even thinking about what I could be doing or should be doing, not at all what I actually wanted to be doing, but about how what I was doing was being perceived, and whether it was perceived in the right way, and whether it was the right thing to be doing. And so when I came to Notre Dame, I very much had that mindset. And I remember how exhausting it was. And I don't even think I realized what it was that was so exhausting until something kind of knocked me out of it. And that's where the afro came in, because I cut my hair for the first time all the way down to pretty much bald. I think it was a one or a zero on the razor. So it wasn't fully bald, but it was about as close as you can go at the end of my freshman year for the Bald and the Beautiful, which is a fundraiser that Notre Dame puts on to raise money for cancer research. And after I cut it, I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to let it grow. I've never let it grow out evenly. This is a great time to let it grow because it's totally even. It's literally all gone, so it's not going to grow out in a weird way. And I'm just going to let it keep growing. And I'm not going to cut it until I feel like I have a reason to cut it. And it just grew. And over time, as it got longer, I realized that people started to see me differently. And as I said before on the niche comment, they started to seem not uncomfortable in a bad way, but uncomfortable around me in the sense that they didn't know what to expect. Once my hair got past a certain threshold of being abnormal or just unique, until they were kind of like, what is this guy about? What does he do? What interests him? Why does he dress like this? Why does he look like this? Because there was something weird about it. And that was really liberating. And that's where I realized for the first time, looking back on how I had always lived, that I was kind of censoring my own behavior. I was forcing myself to live in a certain way that seemed cool based on where I had grown up, or cool based on the people that I had looked up to. And the afro kind of just broke me out of that and made me realize, wait a second, if I just live freely, this hair helps me to do that, because this is one, my natural hair. And this natural hair is now allowing me to kind of act in my own unique way. And that's something that people like and that people are responding well to. And I think that kind of just set off an avalanche of sorts where the hair made me start acting a little bit more authentic. When I did that, I started meeting people that vibes more with my authentic self and that I really should have been friends with. And then they brought out more authentic parts of me. And it just continued to grow and snowball until eventually I mentioned I would start walking around barefoot, or I would find trees on campus that looked like fun to climb. And rather than thinking, should I climb that tree? That'd be a weird thing to do. People walking by would judge that. I was just like, that's an awesome tree. I'm going to go get in the tree and climb it. And I'll never forget, there was one moment right before I graduated my senior year where it felt like this whole thing had peaked. This is literally the summit of it, because I not only saw that tree in the middle of the busiest quad and decided to climb it, which is something that I never would have done my freshman year, but I got seven people to climb up in the tree and sit there for an hour, and more, like many, many more than that stopped by on their way to class to talk to us, to ask us, what the heck are you guys doing? What's going on? Why are you up in this tree? And it literally felt like this little snowball for me, and just like pulling in energy, pulling in authenticity. And it was really, really incredible. So yeah, I think the afro was kind of like the catalyst for the process.
I absolutely love that. Because, I mean, this is the guy who's rapping Macklemore in the big furry coat when I go see him in his performance on campus. How did you get out of that state that so many people are stuck in. Oh, I have to live a certain way. I have to do something to look cool. You mentioned that. How did you, what bounced you out of that?
Yeah, I think that really is the most important question. And I wish that I had a good answer for it. And I don't know that I do, but I'll speculate as to what I think at this point. Somebody the other day put it very well, I think. They said, everybody craves to understand and to be understood. And I think that even more deeply than that, we crave to be loved and to love, which I think those two things are very closely related. And so I think the key ingredient to being able to feel like you can be yourself, like you can live vulnerably and authentically, is just feeling like you'll be understood and you'll be loved by the people around you. If you don't feel like that, it doesn't matter what you do personally, you will never feel able and you will never be able to live as yourself and to live vulnerably, because you're going to feel like you'll get hurt if you do, like you'll be hated, like there will be people that will respond negatively. And so I think for me, there were really two things that happened there. One was just meeting some incredible people at Notre Dame, people that I still say to this day, we're not friends with each other based on a thing that we do or an attribute based on like where we live or what classes we're in. We're friends because we like each other's souls. We're really drawn towards the most fundamental elements of the other person. So as long as that didn't change, as long as their values and really the core of their heart didn't change, it doesn't matter if they move to another continent and change jobs and get remarried or have kids or all these other artificial things change, we would still be just as good of friends because we're really drawn towards the innermost part of that human. So that was the first thing, I think, is just really connecting with those people that made me feel like I could. And then I think the other thing was a desire to want to be understood in a deep level, not just, let me give an example. Not just when you walk into a new class or a camp or something and people say like, tell us your favorite flavor of ice cream and your name and where you're from and your major. And you answer that and it's like, oh good, this is a nice little icebreaker. We're getting to know each other. But then you kind of go home feeling very empty and misunderstood. So it's like, no one really knows anything about me based on those things that I said. And I think that along with meeting these people that made me feel like it was okay to be vulnerable and it was okay to be myself, I started to feel frustrated with the fact that I wasn't. And I started to feel frustrated with this lack of understanding when I would present myself as a kid from California who had surfed, who wore these cool brands that were popular where I grew up, who studied this thing. I didn't feel like anyone actually knew who I was. And so I think I started kind of sampling out answers that were weirder. And rather than answering, actually, I think I did this on multiple occasions, rather than answering where I was from or my major, I would say, well, how about I tell you what I love doing on a Saturday afternoon? Or how about I tell you the weirdest thing about me? Or something else that gives them real information. And again, I go back to that point at the beginning that it takes both. It takes you wanting to be vulnerable there for the sake of being fully understood and fully loved. But it also takes there being people around you that respond positively to that. Because if I had been missing one of those things, I don't think that I ever would have been able to realize that there was a benefit to opening my heart up, to leading with my heart, to living more vulnerably. Because if I didn't have the people around me, I would have tried and I would have felt like I had put myself out there and been hurt for it. And nobody wanted to see the real parts of myself. And on the flip side, if I had those people around me, but I hadn't been willing to and I hadn't desired to do it myself, then I could have wasted a beautiful opportunity to meet some amazing people and to grow into myself with them. So I think it's kind of the pair of those two.
Tell me about a particular interaction with someone in which you truly felt like, I can fully release those masks. I can fully be the authentic Matt Williams. Perhaps touch on something at Notre Dame when you started to first think about this whole concept of seeking to be understood and understanding other people fully.
Phenomenal question. And immediately when you start asking that, a very specific conversation comes to mind. So one of my best friends, my roommate senior year, Jonah, is also somebody with very long hair. My hair went up, his hair went down. He had hair down past his shoulders. So I wonder if there's some correlation there between the hair and the way we-
It's about the hair.
I actually met him through a friend in my dorm freshman year, and I didn't really know him. He was one of those friends of a friend. I had met him once or twice, and I was having a group of guys from the dorm that I had been living in at the time, Duncan Hall, come out to my house in California for spring break, and we were just gonna hang out and go to the beach and explore California because they were all from the Midwest or the East Coast. And 2 weeks before we left, we were walking back from the dining hall, and this guy, Jonah, who knew one of the friends that was coming, asked me point blank, hey, can I come to your house over spring break? And I was like, wow, like, I don't really know you. Like, we never really talked, but I respect that you asked. Like, heck yeah, if you want to come. I mean, you're very like straightforward. Let's do it. That's awesome. And so he booked a flight and he came with us. And the first night that everyone was there, we actually had the Glee Club that I was also in happened to be in California at the same time. So we just had a ton of people over from Notre Dame. I think we probably had 30 or 40 Notre Dame guys over at our house at the same time. And we played ping pong and stuff. We hung out and had a little party. And then when everybody left and everybody went to sleep, Jonah and I were the last two people awake. And we were like, hey, well, you want to go sit outside on the patio and look at the stars and look at the ocean for a little bit and just talk. And we, for the next maybe hour and a half, 2 hours, just totally opened up about what we had been motivated by throughout our lives, what had led us to Notre Dame, what was kind of leading us through our time at Notre Dame. And I don't think that's anything that I did. I think that speaks to Jonah's quality as one of those people that encourages you to be vulnerable and that, and I would even say challenges you to be vulnerable, because there's this direct relationship of, if I am more vulnerable, then I will feel more loved and more understood. And Jonah has this remarkable quality to do that that I don't even know how to describe. And I don't know if I'll ever have, but he really just brings that out of people. And so long story short, the point of the conversation or the impact of the conversation on me was just feeling, I think really for the first time, like, I could say anything to this person right now. And as long as it's honest, and as long as I'm trying my best to be honest and honestly represent myself and my feelings and my vulnerabilities and my pain and my strength, he's going to accept it and he's going to like it. And the only thing I could do that would be wrong is not be honest or try to cover up or give some answer that I've given 100 times before. And it felt fundamentally different than meeting somebody at a networking event or whatnot, where you're literally encouraged to give this prepackaged elevator speech that you've rehearsed that's a minute long and that is incredibly tailored. It felt like the polar opposite of that, where it was like, actually, that's the worst possible thing I could tell Jonah right now when he asks me that question. I need to be as vulnerable and honest as possible, and he's going to reward me for doing that. And I think that, honestly, in a lot of ways, kind of set this whole process in motion as well.
We all struggle with vulnerability. And I think you hit it head on when you said there is so much expectation. There are so many messages from companies, from society that say, put up that mask, have that script ready for someone else. How can we practice vulnerability so that when those opportunities arise, like you're sitting there with Jonah and you say, hey, this guy is really willing to accept me and my authentic self. Let me let down the guardrails and just give him myself. How do we better do that?
I think the key is focusing more on individual interactions than it is on societal rule or a mass movement. There's a great author, Brené Brown, I think at the University of Houston, has written a lot on shame and vulnerability and authenticity. And to give an example here, I read her book as part of the 2-year teaching program that I was involved in. And it was a book that was actively promoted and we read her quotes at events. And so it was something, it wasn't just like, oh, this was a good thing. Like it was kind of part of the canon. It was something that was actively taught and actively encouraged. And one of her central pillars is kind of on a mass level, vulnerability and trying to encourage massive groups of people to be vulnerable. Yet throughout my experience in that teaching program, I felt like every time I was vulnerable, I was attacked and I was hurt. It was like, if I open up and I shared something honestly or truthfully, that would be turned around and used against me. And it was really an eye-opening experience after everything we've talked about with Notre Dame to go into an environment that in a very Pavlovian sense made me feel like if I was vulnerable, I would get hurt. It was like at Notre Dame, I had been trained like a dog, like, oh, vulnerability is good. If I act vulnerably, people will reward me. People will tell me that that's good. They'll encourage me and I can do it more and then I encourage them to do it as well. And then in this other environment, it was the total opposite where it was like, oh, every time I've been vulnerable, I've been hurt for it, and it's been a direct result of the vulnerability. So I think that any attempt to change people on a massive level is going to fail, and I don't think that's the approach to take here if we're trying to encourage vulnerability. I think this is really one of those things where the key is identifying people that are vulnerable and working on this one-on-one with somebody that you know very well. For me, it was always about, as I mentioned already, just these key people that came into my life at the right time and made me feel like it was okay to be vulnerable. And I think that losing those people at that time would have had a catastrophic effect, kind of as I saw throughout the last 2 years of teaching. So I think that if we want to practice vulnerability more, the most important thing to do is to find people that are vulnerable. Find somebody, whether that's at work, whether that's in your life, at the sports club that you go to, wherever it is, that you see embodying that vulnerability and become their friend. And I can guarantee it, if it's somebody that's truly vulnerable, they'll want to be your friend, because anybody that's willing to be that vulnerable is never going to be somebody that would say, you're not the right person. I don't want to be seen with you. I don't want to associate with you. So there's this kind of beautiful benefit there that vulnerability, I think, just makes you so fundamentally open that anyone you see that's being vulnerable will probably welcome you into their life with open arms. And I think that's kind of how this grows, is by us finding other vulnerable people around us and then trying to bring other people into that aura of vulnerability. So for example, let's say you and I, Patrick, are both people that encourage and enjoy vulnerability. If we bring somebody else into our friendship and begin having conversations with them that is wanting to be vulnerable but hasn't been able to, I think they're going to start to take on that quality. And then they could bring somebody else in and they'll take it on. And it needs to be this kind of umbrella that we're bringing people under. I don't think it's ever going to be like a pesticide we could just spray over a group of people and then all of a sudden it'll have this mass effect, or a book that everyone could read and all of a sudden they'll learn this massive lesson. It needs to happen organically, and it needs to happen in these one-to-one interactions.
Agreed, Matt. And I think it starts with each of us. It's a choice. I know that's something when I was a freshman at Notre Dame, and I'm looking at who's this Matt Williams, got the afro, everyone knows this guy, bringing the skateboard, he is everywhere. And I look at you, Matt, and I say, wow, this guy is so authentically him. He is not afraid to be himself. And that was so rare, at least my first year at Notre Dame, to find that when I saw that in you, I felt like, wow, there's something there that's inviting me to tap into my own confidence and self-belief to be myself, to be more vulnerable with other people. And that's where I'd like to really dive in, transition a little into the idea of confidence. And I would love to hear about the role of confidence in your life, your journey with confidence, and how that has tied into your ability to be vulnerable with other people.
I think that's a great and important segue, Patrick. Kind of along that segue, I wanted to tell a quick story similar to what you just said, which connects the dots for us between this idea of authenticity and confidence. There was a time senior year as well that I was walking through a quad with our mutual friend, Sean, and somebody was throwing a frisbee with their friend kind of next to us on the grass. We were walking on a concrete path and we didn't know these people. And Sean out of nowhere just goes, "Chuck me the frisbee," and starts running. And they throw him the frisbee, and I think he misses it, and he runs and picks it up, and he throws it back and kind of misses, and then we just keep walking. And I was like, wow, that was amazing. I would have been terrified to do that. Like, thought of just asking two random people to throw you a frisbee. Like, I'm not good at throwing frisbees. Like, what if I miss it? What if I mess up? Like, it just scares me for so many reasons. And you just went for it. How did you just go for it? And Sean was like, well, the fact that we're together and I knew that no matter how bad I had messed up, I'd still have you here to support me made me feel like I could do it. And that's when it really hit me to the points that we were making earlier. It's these people around you that encourage vulnerability and that make you feel safe and kind of give you a safety net that allow this behavior to happen. And I think that that's where confidence grows out of, because Sean felt confident doing that thing, knowing that there was a good chance he could mess up and that he could embarrass himself and that he could look like a goof, because he knew that he had somebody there that loved him and somebody that just wanted him to be himself, no matter how goofy or weird or incredible that could be, and just would love him as long as he was being himself. And I felt the same way. And I recognize that now too, because the more time I spend away from those people, the more I crave that and the more I miss it and the more that I search for people that will bring that out of me and that will accept that. So for me, confidence kind of extending out of that, it's just the idea that you can be yourself without fear of failure or without fear of any negative consequences for your actions. If you are yourself, not to say that you can do things that are wrong and not be afraid of negative consequences. But for example, if I am standing in an elevator with a group of people and I'm wearing my shirt backwards and people notice that, I'm not going to be mortified that, oh my God, my shirt's on backwards. Now everyone saw this. It's going to be like, oh, you know what? I'm kind of goofy. Sometimes I put my shirt on backwards and that's okay. And that's me. That's how I am, I guess. And so now these people know me a little bit better because they saw me do that. And it's feeling comfortable taking those risks of authenticity, taking that risk that you do something authentically. And no matter how it lands, no matter how it ends up actually falling into the earth, no matter what your action ends up being, people around you are going to be okay with it. And even if they're not, it doesn't matter to you.
What was a particular risk or time that you had to tap into your own confidence and courage to overcome maybe a particular mental hurdle in your life up to this point?
Can I turn it back on you to buy myself some time to think?
Are you kidding? Of course. And one thing, based on that story that you just shared about you and Sean on God Quad, most likely in front of the shining golden dome, really got me thinking about the everyday interactions we have with other people. And what I'm talking about is we are very lucky to live in a neighborhood where we have lush green trees, we have paths, we have a beautiful pond just right down, 2 minutes down the road from our house. And what I like to do every afternoon is just go for a walk around the pond, and where I see lots of families, other individuals enjoying the beautiful Portland October weather. And something I always notice, Matt, that really ties into that story you just told, is the event when two strangers are about to cross paths. One person's coming one direction and the other one's going the other direction. And every single time, I'm going to see 99% of the time that I look up at that person coming towards me as I'm about to pass them on the path, the other person puts their head down because, quote, it's awkward. It's easy to do so. It takes confidence to look the other person in the face and say, hey, how you doing? I've thought about that so much, the idea of simply looking someone in the face, even if you don't see a single word, and how that taps into a bit of vulnerability, a bit of confidence, a bit of courage. I don't know if you've even heard of, but so much of this research, I was reading something literally in the last night in the New York Times about to foster human connection. This is going to sound absurd, but people say, if you do this exercise with a spouse, a partner, a friend, a colleague, anyone you want to get to know better, unbelievable things are going to happen. Essentially, you sit down with them for 2 to 4 minutes, don't move, stare into the person's eyes. Don't say a single word, and just be. And just be staring into someone's, as people would say, soul. Unbelievable. That's just what came to mind when you shared that story, and how it takes even those smallest actions. Each of us need to practice that vulnerability, those times of confidence and courage, so that when we're on an edge, like something you're most likely about to share, we can then tap into the confidence we've built up in those small moments over time. What do you say to that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And it makes me think too of similar moments at Notre Dame, walking around where at first I was one of those people that would put my head down or look at my phone or look away. And then throughout this process, eventually changing to become somebody that would try to smile and make eye contact and say something, even if I didn't know that person or didn't know their name, and just how much that changed the experience for me, and hopefully a little bit too for the people around me. And one interesting thing there that I did notice actually throughout the process is that your jaw muscles that control your smile are just like any other muscle in your body. They can grow weak and they can grow stronger. And I remember at first when I started trying to look at people more and smile more, I literally would get tired. My jaw muscles would ache like I had worked them out. And it took time for them to develop the strength and stamina. Now I think I could smile all day and not get tired because I've just gotten so used to doing it constantly. But it was literally hard. Like, it hurt at points. And everyone's probably had that experience at picture day or something where your jaw starts shaking and it's kind of like, I can't hold this anymore. This hurts. Like, I remember being at that point a lot and trying to force myself through it. And also hope that it didn't look odd that my mouth was like shaking while I was trying to smile at somebody. But I did literally have to build that muscle. And so I think the power of eye contact and a smile is immense. I think of two things in terms of confidence. And one might seem like a very mediocre thing. The other one might seem larger. The smaller thing that I think might seem mediocre, but it isn't, is something that a friend did called Wolf Shirt Wednesdays, where she and her friends would wear those really, they're like tie-dye shirts. They're very colorful. And they've got detailed graphics on the front. Like, I think when you think of them, you kind of imagine maybe like an older person or someone at a zoo wearing that shirt with like a big wolf picture on the front, and then it's got like pink tie-dye, and they're kind of goofy and also super incredible. And so her and her friends would wear these, and she got me one as a gift. I think it was a birthday present, and it was like, you should start wearing this on Wednesday with us. And at first I was like, I don't know if I want to wear that. I might have to tuck it in because it's really long and it's kind of weird, and I feel like I have this way that I want to be perceived. And I wasn't saying this to her, but in my head I was thinking like, God, I don't know that I want to like put myself out there like that. And because I knew that she and the other people in her friend group and my friends as well would accept me no matter what, even if I did look super goofy, perhaps borderline crazy, that was ultimately what made me feel like, you know what? All right, that's fine. I'm going to take the risk, even though I feel like it might be really goofy, even though I feel like people might think it's weird. I'm going to go for it. And it ended up being the opposite of what I had thought. It was incredible. People loved it. Teachers loved it. People at the dining hall loved it. And for the rest of my time at Notre Dame, every Wednesday, I proceeded to wear this bright pink shirt with a massive wolf on the front of it. And usually I would tuck it into my jeans. And that's when I'd skip down the quad barefoot and just try to go all in. And I think one of those days, actually, I skipped all the way down South Quad barefoot with this bright pink shirt on, carrying my backpack, just to kind of see how it felt and see what other people did. And it was this really liberating moment where I realized, to be honest, probably for the first time in my life, I don't really care what anybody thinks and what anybody does right now. I'm really happy doing this. And I'm going to keep doing it no matter what happens. If people were to start yelling at me, I would still keep going. It doesn't matter how weird it seems. I'm really enjoying this. That's a smaller thing. On a bigger level, I think there was a day in one of my business classes where we were invited to give 1-minute elevator pitches to try to get a job from the professor who had a very successful career entrepreneurially and had founded a couple companies. And I thought a lot of people were going to sign up to do this. And it turned out, like, I think only 2 or 3 did, including me. And this was not at all my forte. This was not at all something that I would have felt comfortable doing. I hate speaking in front of people. There were, I think, 105 people in this class, one of those massive lecture halls where everybody's above you too, which doesn't help. So you're like down in this pit and everyone's looking down at you. And I was super nervous, but I had committed to doing it. So I was like, you know what? All right, I'm going to do this. This is a good opportunity for growth, a good opportunity to be confident, to put myself out there. And in writing the elevator pitch that I was going to give, I kept hitting this roadblock where I was like, I really don't feel good about that. I think this is going to go poorly. And I realized eventually that it was just that I was trying to tell my teacher and the people around me what they wanted to hear. I wasn't writing something authentic and vulnerable. And I knew that if I did, it didn't matter how badly I might have failed, I would still feel good about the outcome. If I wrote this amazing, perfect elevator pitch and failed, I would feel guilty because it wasn't me. It wasn't authentic. I went up there and I failed at some prepackaged little thing. But if I wrote this goofy Matt Williams song or poem or speech or whatever it was, and I failed, I would feel awesome because at the very least, I had been myself and I had put myself out there. And that's a win no matter what happened. So long story short, I went to the dining hall that morning. I borrowed a raw potato from the people in the dining hall. And I wrote this 1-minute rhyme about all the things that I could do with a potato. And I proceeded. I walked down to the stage in front of the class. I snapped my fingers and had a friend from the top row toss me the potato. I thought I was going to drop it. I think somehow I managed to catch the potato. And then I went through a list, kind of in rhyme, kind of like a little song almost, of all the things I could do with the potato, including using it as a paperweight or using it to get a date. And then I got down on a knee and asked the girl in the front row out on a date using the potato. At the very end of the speech, I tossed the potato to the professor who was sitting on like the third row back and said, if I can do those many things or that many things with a potato, just imagine what I can do for your business. And then I walked back up to my seat and sat down. And to this day, I think it was one of the most epic things I've ever done. I don't know how it was perceived. I don't know how he thought it was perceived or anyone else did, but I felt so good about it because it was so authentically me. It was goofy. It was silly. It was something that I had come up with. It was something that you probably never would have been advised to do by a real business advisor or anyone that knows how things work. But I just felt good about it because it came from the heart. And I think that was an instance where I really had to let that confidence come out, knowing that if I fail here, at least I was myself and I have people around me that love me for that. Even if they're not in this class, I have them there and they'll support me.
Bring me into that potato story a little bit more. You're standing there on the stage. You toss the potato to your teacher. The class is probably going berserk. You just pull a mic drop, like, give me the job now with that elevator pitch. Say a little bit more about, again, that feeling of freeness you felt when you were able to be your authentic self and you saw it be accepted by the people around you.
Well, I think the biggest way to describe that, going back to something that we said earlier, it's just, where are you perceiving yourself from? When you think about your own presence in that moment, are you viewing it from the perspective of those around you? Or are you viewing it from your own eyeballs looking out at the world with this kind of agnostic attitude about the world itself? So for example, what I mean by that, I think that before that time, if I had ever done anything like that, I would not have been viewing the people up in those seats from my perspective on stage. I would have been viewing myself from their perspective in the seats. And I would have been thinking the whole time about, how does this look? How do I look right now? Are my hands in the right place? Am I facing the right direction? Does my hair look okay? Am I saying this weird? What does my voice sound like? But instead, in that moment, I didn't care at all. And I wasn't thinking at all about what anybody in the audience might have been receiving this as. I was just thinking about what it felt like to me and what felt good and what felt fun and what felt free. And so after it, what I felt when I walked back to my seat and sat down wasn't, oh God, who's looking at me? Does this look okay right now? It was just like, wow. It was like sinking into a sauna or a hot tub and just that like, oh, like I can let go of all that tenseness in my shoulders, of all that pressure. I don't need to worry about anything else right now. I can just exist here in this moment. And that's how I describe it. And I don't know if it feels like that to other people, but I think kind of central to this whole conversation about authenticity and confidence for me is just the idea of where do you perceive yourself from your own perspective looking out at the world or from the perspective of other people looking in. And to the idea of niche that we brought up earlier, I think that's where the niche is so important because that's where you create that space for yourself to stand and look out as opposed to always trying to kind of figure out how are other people looking at me? Where are other people placing me?
And currently you are out of Notre Dame. You're done with teaching, with Teach for America. And like a lot of people, you're finding it to be challenging and take quite a bit of effort outside of school to bring that same authenticity, to feel like you can still be that vulnerable self in the workplace setting where there are certain professional standards. It's a very different ball game in a sense, but yet you still can bring vulnerability, bring confidence, bring courage. How have you been able to do that? How are you going about that process?
I'll start by saying that I don't think I'm doing necessarily the best job. And I would love to hear other people's answers to this question because I know that I have a lot to learn here. But some of the initial things that I have tried and have been thinking about are the idea that it's a trade-off between authenticity and efficiency in the sense that I think the reason why school or a business pushes people away from being authentic isn't because it's evil and it wants to suppress and silence your authentic self. It's because it's easier and faster and more efficient if everybody just kind of acts in the same way or if everybody only presents certain parts. For example, I was at dinner with a friend the other night and we were talking about the idea that my parents have told me 100 times, never talk about sex, politics, or religion at work because those are the most contentious issues and you never want to bring that up with someone. And I was saying, but that's terrible advice because those are like the three most interesting things about somebody. If you really want to get to know somebody, you have to know what they think about those three things. That's like fundamental to their being and to their identity. And so what we kind of came to realize is that there's this trade-off right now where on one hand, there's this idea that if we suppress those things, if we ignore them, if we only see this very basic tailored version of each other, we don't have to worry about any disagreements. We don't have to worry about any tension or friction. And we can just do our jobs and show up to work. We'll do the things we're supposed to do and we'll go on our way. And that creates this very efficient system. We're literally like little cogs in a machine. There's no differences between us. We're just the same shape. We can spin together very well. On the other hand, you can imagine a world or a business where everybody shows up wearing what they want to wear, saying what they want to say, what they believe, and they're held together by love and admiration for each other. And they respect each other, even if they differ in opinion or differ in belief or differ in anything else, because they have these common values. They have this mutual admiration, this mutual respect. They're bought into the same mission. That system will probably be a lot slower and a lot less efficient, but I think that's okay. And again, I say it's a trade-off because I think there are benefits to both. What we get from slowing down and taking time to be authentic, what we get from breaking up that monotony and that homogeneity in order to let our differences thrive is more creativity and it's more meaning from the work. The work that you're doing, even if you can't do it as fast or can't do as much of it, I think will be much more deeply creative. It'll be more meaningful to you and to the world around you. And so I think this question is one, not just for individuals, but for every entity, corporation, or school in terms of trade-offs. Where are we on the spectrum right now? Are we emphasizing homogeneity too much to the point that people don't feel like they can be themselves? Or are we maybe emphasizing authenticity so much that we're not getting enough done? We're not able to meet our goals. We're not able to rise to the challenge that's put before us because we're moving too slow. Or maybe there are challenges because of this authenticity. And I think it's just about trying to strike the balance because the way we talk about our time at Notre Dame, I don't think at this point that that's how somebody should act in their workplace because I think it is a fundamentally different relationship. And I think you could make people feel deeply uncomfortable showing up to work like that. If I showed up barefoot in a pink wolf shirt and wanted to talk to people about their deepest longing in life on a day where we're supposed to try to finish something for a client, there's probably an error in that equation. That's not a recipe for success. But I don't think we should have to show up and ignore all the details about our identity and all the details about what make us who we are just for the sake of getting through the job as fast as we can. So it's just about striking that balance. And I think that as long as we're asking ourselves that question repeatedly, and a corporation that we work for, a school that we attend is asking themselves that question repeatedly, we'll get to a good place. And we're going to have to recalibrate here and there as we move too far to one end of the spectrum or another. But I think that it is a question of balance.
Mm. So you have had so many experiences and opportunity inside the classroom and in schools, whether it was through Teach for America these last couple of years, getting your master's in education. Now you're currently a consultant, a higher education consultant with your job. Bring me through how you view education as the kind of the bedrock for this future. There's a great quote from you, Matt, that I was able to find. I believe that it's America's circulatory system, the most foundational industry in our economy. That was you talking about the education system. Bring me into your view of the American education system and where you see education going and how we can impact the youth in terms of educating the future in this world.
Well, we need a whole other podcast, not even an episode, to break down that question some more. A couple of kind of initial thoughts. For example, in your bedroom, if you think about the most important item, it's probably your bed, and specifically, it's probably your mattress, just based on the amount of time you're going to spend there. Your clothes, your alarm clock, your phone even, the chairs, the lighting, that's all very insignificant relative to your mattress, because you're going to spend, what, a third of your life, most likely, give or take, on that mattress. So in the same way, if you think about education and the role that it plays in our lives, specifically in the American context, which we're most familiar with, spend the majority of your formative years in school or on retreats for school or at sports practices for school. I mean, when I think about my childhood growing up, I went to school most days, I want to say at 7:30, and I was on campus until usually 6:30 or 7 at night, either at the library or attending a club or attending a sports practice. So literally 12 hours of my day sometimes were spent on campus, and the time that I was home was the majority asleep. So most of my formative experiences, the relationships that I formed, the people that were imprinting on me and telling me how to view the world and how to approach the world came through school. And so when I say that it's the circulatory system of America's economy and society, that's really what I mean, is it produces people on a fundamental level, not just in an economic sense in their utility, but in a really raw emotional, spiritual, just humanistic sense. It's what produces the people that will then go out and work in our companies, that will serve in our public goods, that will build things for us, that will treat us when we're sick or take care of us when we're in need. And so if we want to deal with any of the challenges that we're facing in society, it all starts in schools. And you know, that's something that I remember people always saying in economics classes or business classes, when a question of anything moral or any big problem would come up, they'd say, it all starts with education. And that's one of the reasons, to be honest, why I went to teach, because I was like, well, why isn't anyone doing anything about education? That we're sitting here in this business ethics class talking about the problem of consumerism, we're talking about the problem of technology, we're talking about the problem of mass production and saying that it all falls back on education, and yet none of us have any plan to ever do anything in education. So I kind of wanted to just put my money where my mouth was and see what the power of an educator is. And in many ways, that's still the journey that I'm on, just in a different form. So in terms of where that's going in the future, I think that we're going to see a really big shift away from educating for a job to educating a whole human for the role that they'll play in society. Now, I think that the biggest barrier there is that most education is sponsored by someone or something. It's paid for by something. For example, at the Smithsonian, where I spent the summer designing curriculum, the major funders behind that science curriculum is scientific industry, the pharmaceutical companies, the big research companies, the technology companies and engineering companies that are paying a company like the Smithsonian or an institute like the Smithsonian to build this curriculum. So every part of education has some stakeholder behind it who has an interest, a specific interest in what that curriculum will achieve or what that educational model will achieve. Just because that's the way our economy works. No one's going to pay me to design the super pro-democratic curriculum if it doesn't benefit them in some way. I have to prove to them that there's some benefit. So I think the challenge before us is trying to move curricular models and classrooms toward the human-centric vision of education that educates the whole human to be a productive member of society, to be open-minded, to be humble and change their mind when they're wrong, to engage with people from a place of love and trying to understand rather than hatred and trying to divide. All these soft skills that we talk about today as being so important politically. But the challenge there is, who's going to pay for that? How are we going to get the people writing this curriculum, the people delivering it, the people in the classrooms, the people behind the scenes, the administrators that make it all work, to be incentivized for that type of education? Because that's something that no one's going to directly pay for. There's always some ulterior motive. And I don't mean that in a bad way when we're funding a curriculum or when we're funding a model. So that, I think, is really our big question to reckon with, is these decisions that we're making about the education system that will have this monumental effect on the people that go through that education system and then run our society for the next couple of generations. Why are we making those decisions? Why are we designing things in that way? Who's paying for it? What are the goals? And are those really the goals that we want it to have?
Investing in those skills, as you mentioned, empathy, vulnerability, compassion, patience, gratitude. I mean, I think you put resources towards that in the sense that you're saying, and we could see a whole other world, Matt. We could see an absolutely whole different world. Hey, I'd like to finish with a couple things. First of all, with a quote from you about this current time period that we're all in, obviously with the pandemic, the virus. The pandemic is helping each of us grow in empathy. Extroverts now have a better sense of what it feels like to be an introvert. Young people have a better sense of what it's like to be older and retired. Matt, how can each of us wrap up this empathy, this vulnerability, this compassion, these patience that we're learning during this time of the pandemic, and really continue exhibiting this empathy long after this pandemic is over?
I think it's the same question at the root of any experience you undertake. If you go to a summer camp and you have this amazing experience, you make these great friends, and then you have to go home in a week and you say, well, how are we going to stay in touch? How are we going to kind of let this experience continue to have an impact on us? I mean, that happens all the time at all different parts of our life. And I think that's really the question we face with this pandemic is, once we go back to normal, if we do, how are we going to let these lessons that we've learned stay with us? And I don't know that there's a right answer there, or really even a one-size-fits-all recommendation. But personally, for me, I think that I'm just going to try to keep it at the top of my mind. I'm going to try to think about the things that I appreciated throughout the pandemic, as opposed to the things that were challenging. When I come out of it, I want my memory not to be one of how difficult it was, or all the problems, or all the things that were canceled. I mean, and we had some awesome things planned, Patrick. Like, we had some incredible, we were going to go raft the Grand Canyon. We had some amazing concerts planned, trips to see my parents, things that I really wanted to do. But I haven't thought about that at all, to be honest. And once this is all over, I don't plan on thinking about that either. Instead, I want to focus on those lessons that I learned and that new understanding that I developed that I wouldn't have otherwise, how grateful I am to have that understanding. I think it's kind of up to us to frame our memory of this experience in that way. Ultimately, how we feel about it, what we come out of it knowing, is totally in our control based on what we choose to focus on. Do we choose to focus on the negative parts, the hardships, or do we choose to focus on the lessons that we learned and how we can take those with us going forward? It's up to us.
Love that. Perspective. Perspective is everything. Leave us with two things. The best piece of advice, or one of them, that you've ever received. And number two, your choice of a dinner guest, if given the choice to have a one-on-one dinner.
Oh man, I wish you had given me these questions ahead of time. These are amazing questions. The best piece of advice I've ever received. You know what, to be honest, I don't think I've received as much advice face-to-face as I would like. So I'm going to take something out of a book. So this might seem like a cop-out, but the piece of advice coming out of a book that I read is, I wish you modest success. And I think that that's very important. The character in the book that hears it says, I don't know what that means. And the guy who gave him the advice says, I didn't either when I was your age. And I think that's kind of an important part of it too, is that that's an idea that might not make sense to everyone at every point in time. But at least for me, as I've kind of grown more into these ideas that we've talked about and tried to get my priorities in line as I set off on this path of life to build a family, to build a life for myself, I think that's a really important idea, that I don't want anything to be too extreme. I don't want anything to be too, I mean, we talked about balance. I don't want it to be out of balance. So I think that I wish you modest success is really the best way to wish someone well, in my opinion. And if that doesn't totally make sense, I would just challenge someone to sit there with that for a while and contemplate that some more. And I don't know that I fully understand it at this point either, to be honest. So I should give that caveat as well. And then in terms of a dinner guest, oh man, that's so hard. I think at this point in time, the person that I would be most interested to talk to is anybody completely unknown from the early 1900s. I don't want a celebrity. I don't want somebody that anybody would know. Somebody that's a complete no name. Nobody knew who they were from a time, maybe let's say 100 years, 110 years before we're alive now. And what I'm really interested in at this point is just what feels different. I would want to spend 3 hours with them just unpacking how basic day-to-day things feel, how they feel when they see another person. To your point earlier, when you're walking down the street and you see people, do you look at them? Do you smile at them? Do you look away? If you're standing in a cafe waiting for your coffee, what are you doing? Are you talking to people around you? Are you looking at the wall? Are you reading a newspaper? And what I'm really interested in is the differences in their everyday life and ours, because I think that we have a bad tendency to take things for granted and to accept that the way things are right now is the way they've always been and the way that they always will be. And that's where I'd be really curious, not to talk to somebody famous that has this very unique, eccentric experience, but to talk to somebody very ordinary to see just how different an ordinary experience was 100 years ago as opposed to today. And I think that would teach me a lot about my quote-unquote ordinary experience of today.
I think we all would learn a ton if we got to have a conversation like that with someone who lived 100 years ago. But man, such a gift having this conversation. You're awesome. You're awesome.
Thanks, Patrick. It's always a pleasure. You're awesome. You're one of those people that makes me feel like it's safe and okay to be myself. So you are just as much part of that journey as anyone. I just didn't want to stroke your ego the whole time while we're sitting here. But although I didn't mention your name, you are as significant on that list as anyone else. So it's always a pleasure.